listening to By the Well, a podcast brought to you from Pilgrim Theological College and the Uniting Church in Australia, where we discuss the lectionary readings to help you preach the good news in your communities. I'm Fran Barber.
And I'm Robin Whittaker. And today's readings are Genesis 28, 10 to 19, Romans 8, 12 to 25, and Matthew 13, 24 to 30, and 36 to 43.
So Genesis 28, Robin, with Jacob sleeping and with the rock as his pillow. What would you bring out to preach on in that in this passage this week?
I think for me the dominant theme, or a really preachable theme, is encountering God in surprising places.
Mm-hmm.
So Jacob at this point is a man on the run.
Yep.
He's fleeing from Esau. He's tricked Esau thoroughly out of his birthright and tricked his father Isaac into blessing him. He seems to be alone here. He's got nothing with him, hence the pulling up a stone as a pillow. And in this place where he doesn't expect to find God or experience God's mercy, he has this incredibly profound experience of the divine with this, the Hebrew word that we often translate ladder is really tricky. It's a ramp or some kind of gateway into heaven, but we have this very vivid vision of angels ascending and descending, this sense of like God coming down to him. And we can play around with that imagery, but I don't think it's the point of the story so much as God visiting him. And the other profound part of it is when God visits him, God reiterates the covenant to him. So the covenant that was given to Abraham, then was given to Isaac, is now given to Jacob, even though he's tricked his way into it.
Yes. Like, what do we do with that?
Well, again, I think it is one of these themes of God, of God's faithfulness to what he promised Abraham, despite the brokenness and failure perhaps of Abraham's offspring to behave in the most upright ways.
Well, despite the fact they might be undeserving.
Yes, exactly.
Of that honour.
Yeah, I think that's
right.
Or
that privilege, yeah.
Yeah, so it's not that Jacob has earned this in any kind of way, and yet God's faithfulness to the promise, to the covenant, is to unequivocally say in verse 14 or so, it starts 13 and 14, I, the Lord, this is this Yahweh language, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, the land on which you lie, I will give to you and your seed, and so on. But for me, the point of the story is that Jacob wakes up and is somewhat astonished that the Lord is in this place, and he says, I did not know it. So this was not the holy ground he expected.
Yeah.
And then he takes that pillow, that stone, and turns it into a pillar. It becomes a marker, and he calls the place Beth El, which means house of God.
Right, which presumably now we could go back to and it's still recognised as that.
Yeah,
so it's an important place in Israel's geography.
Yes, and a contested place.
Yes.
So apparently there are traditions I don't fully understand, but around Bethel then becoming this sanctuary and being fenced off and priests charging money for people to enter it. So later on Hosea and Micah, the later prophets, will be very critical of Bethel. But it does become an actual place. It gets renamed. So for preachers, I think there's rich stuff to play with in terms of where are the surprising places we find God.
And by surprising, I'd like to push that for it to mean boringly ordinary.
Yes.
So, I mean, not that being bereft in a – I presume he's in a desert place, but is boring in that.
But no,
it's unexpected, but it's ordinary.
Yeah, he's just in regular country. This isn't a marked out as sacred space.
And as we've already said, he's done a pretty bad thing. So that's another dimension to the surprisingness that, you know, the way God encounters us is persistently loving.
Yeah.
Unexpected places.
And as we've noticed in earlier Genesis stories, say with Ishmael when he was, you know, dying out in the desert and God sees and hears him, and then we get told God's presence is with the boy. God's presence in all of these texts is a sign of blessing, that God will find people in these places that are kind of on the fringes, that should be dangerous and outlying places, and yet God finds them. But I take your point. There is something about God in the incredibly ordinary place.
Yeah, which we talk about with the parables in a moment.
Yeah.
But what is significant too about God found is that God is the acting party here. So when we've talked often in popular culture around God or looking for God, have you found Jesus, those sort of things, which have become, you know, trite. But we turn it around in ways that does a disservice to the gospel when we talk about us looking for God, when actually the gospel is about God seeking us all the time and finding us despite our attempts to hide.
Yeah. I do think theologically that's important. And there's an article on Working Preacher by Juliana Klassens, who's a South African scholar, and she writes that God finds Jacob here in his most vulnerable moment on the run. So there's God finding us in the vulnerability.
Yeah, not in the strength of triumph.
Yeah.
Or worldly triumph, you know.
There's one other thing I'd say for particularly those preaching in Australian contexts. There are things going on with land here in Genesis that are deeply important. So that Jacob's experience of God in this place causes him to make a pillar that he anoints with oil. Where the oil comes from is a great mystery. But it becomes anointed, and in doing so it becomes a sacred place that's part of the story. And so when people hear the name Bethel later on, it reminds them of this story, that this is where God is.
And of their identity.
Which goes right to the heart of identity as a called and covenanted people. I've been reading this year a fabulous book called Gondwana Theology by a colleague of ours, Gary Deverell, who's an Indigenous Australian priest. And he talks there about it really helped me understand some things around, he talked about the land in the Indigenous tradition and the way it's storied. Has some similarities to the way Hebrews in Genesis and other places talk about land, because the naming of places and the association of them with a certain story. So he talks about the land in Indigenous culture being its own sacred text.
Yeah.
Because it does that storytelling. And I just think for Australians, there's, if you're a bit informed about those things, there's also some wonderful connections that could be made here, or perhaps a chance invite in some Indigenous voices to your space as we think about these stories.
And even that observation that you've drawn really offers profundity and nuance to our reading of the land there. Like, as you know, we're from a tradition where land is owned.
Yes.
You know, and so we don't see those nuances unless they're pointed out to us by someone like Gary, for example.
Exactly. And Jacob doesn't own this land. I mean, it's sort of given to his people ultimately. But the later prophets that I mentioned before are harshly critical of the way Bethel then gets fenced and kept.
Yeah, I was thinking that's
so
doing
they what attempt to own
domesticate the sacred, and domesticate it.
Yeah, they attempt to own a sacred place that doesn't actually just belong to a small group of people. So there's some things there to play with that are certainly culturally very relevant
in
Australia.
Yeah.
Romans, Fran.
Oh, Romans.
We're in Romans 8 again, where, well, maybe there's a slight connection here, where creation groans.
Yeah.
Do you want to start there, or what else do we need to know about?
I suppose I wanted to just recall something else from Gaventa's book that I mentioned last week about how Romans, unlike Thessalonians or Galatians or even Corinthians, they're given pretty clear reasons why the letter was there in the letters themselves. Part of our the complexity of Romans is that it's not totally clear what provoked the writing of the letter. But Gaventa says that the thesis she thinks for it all is in chapter 1, verse 16 to 17. I'm just going to read it because it does bear on this current passage in chapter 8. "For I am not ashamed," says Paul, "for I am not ashamed of the gospel. For it is God's own power bringing about salvation for everyone who believes, the Jew first and also the Greek. For in the gospel, God's rectification is being apocalyptically revealed from faith for faith, just as it is written, the righteous one will live from faith." I'm just want to read that out because I think perhaps going back to that verse will help people to traverse other passages in the letter. But in particular, when he says God's own power to bring about salvation for everyone who believes, the Jew first and also the Greek, bears into the main theme in this passage in chapter 8 about our adoption.
Mm.
So that as Gentiles, we are given the spirit of adoption. God's love is so lavish and wide that we are given this intimate relationship with God that through Jesus that we can call God by that intimate name, Abba.
Abba Father.
Abba Father. So I think in terms of focusing for a preaching theme, you could do a lot worse than talk about our adoption. And
yeah. And the comparison Paul makes in that passage around verse 15, 16 there is being children of God as opposed to being slaves. So mm. even though God is worthy of service, and Paul, interestingly, in several letters does introduce himself as a slave of God, mm-hmm. a doulos or slave or servant of mm-hmm. God. But here he's making the point that we have a more elevated status. Mm. We're welcomed as Jesus, mm. as siblings of Christ. Which I guess speaks to just the generosity of God, the grace.
And the desire for God to have a relationship with us, which we've actually talked about in the Jacob reading just now.
Yeah.
You know, God came to him and found him. God is persistently wanting to be in our space.
Yes, and not as a lording over master,
but
as a deeply parental in this image.
And transforming, loving presence and power. And that is our objective reality, not what we think is real and true around us.
Yeah.
So Paul then goes on here, of course, but he's acknowledging the difficulties and the ambiguities of everyday life as Christians in the reference to the sufferings.
Yeah.
You know, the sufferings of the present time aren't compared to the glory that will be revealed to us.
Yes, because part of that, you know, being siblings of Christ image is that, yes, there are times we share in Christ's suffering, but the promise is we will share in Christ's glory, which is to be not just the resurrection, but really elevation to sitting, you know, if Christ is sitting at the right hand of God, to kind of shared rule in this kingdom, which is precisely why God's kingdom is so fundamentally different to human kingdoms, because it is a shared rule, not as as equals.
And also this passage moving from verse 19 onwards taps into what we were talking about last week when I talked about the cosmic nature of Paul's vision for salvation.
Mm.
It is not just, sin doesn't just apply to us as human beings, but actually there are forces of evil and darkness through all of creation and that in through Christ God has transformed those things and will do so fully.
Yeah.
And so then he talks about creation waiting with eager longing, and it's a very evocative passage.
Yeah, it's quite beautiful. Creation groaning and labour pains
You know, I think for anyone who's given birth, that's a really, you know, the pain and the hard work for what you hope for at the end, you know, that it's very evocative.
Yeah.
That such imagery should be used of God or is, I think, something we shouldn't pass over too quickly.
Yeah, all the world around us. I mean, Paul was not a greenie in any contemporary sense of being an environmentalist, and yet his theology here says that we as human beings are deeply connected to the rest of creation. We cannot separate ourselves from it because God's the brokenness that infects the entire cosmos is the redemption that is promised to the entire cosmos. So,
bondage to decay, another evocative phrase.
So that's Romans
I think that's, you know, by no means comprehensive. but
a couple of themes.
Tie into. I'm not sure there are strong links with the other two readings this week, but
no,
certainly again, put it in the comments on the Facebook page if you find
if you see some links. The one last thing I'd say about adoption too is if you do pick up that theme theologically is a bit of pastoral sensitivity. I think too often in our culture adoption is seen as a second choice to biological offspring.
Yeah.
And so it can feel like not quite as equal. And so, I mean, this is obviously deeply problematic for what it communicates in all sorts of horrible ways to adopted children. But in the ancient world, we have stories of incredibly wealthy, you know, people, including emperors, who had their own biological children that they still chose to adopt because the adopted child was preferable. So again, not unproblematic, but in Paul's day and age, adoption was not necessarily a lesser choice or a necessary choice out of a lack of being able to have biological children. It was often a choice because that way you got to pick the child you wanted. So there's a sense in this adoption imagery here of God choosing us. It's a different context.
Well, I just see parallels too in the very fact that Jesus, you know, we talked about this before, that family values are not Christian.
No.
And that actually who's in Jesus' community, he is emphasized in Matthew a lot particularly, are not born into, you're not born into it. You actually have to learn, and that's what the parables are, just to skip ahead a bit.
You're adopted into it.
You're not, it's not as easy as being born into it. So I see the adoption named here by Paul to be consistent
with Jesus' teaching. Yep. No, that's true. Your new Christian family is one that both you choose and it chooses you, that has nothing to do with biology.
It's not inheritance in the biological sense, no. which is an easy thing. I mean, in inverted commas.
Yeah. Okay, so on to Matthew.
Yes.
We are continuing in chapter 13 this week with the second parable. We talked briefly about parables last time with the parable of the sower, and we have a similar, or at least it starts in a similar way in 13:24, with Jesus putting before them another parable. This one starts in a more typical way for parables, which are often about the kingdom in the Gospels. Most of Jesus' teaching about the kingdom, which is sometimes called the kingdom of God and sometimes called the kingdom of heaven. Matthew prefers kingdom of heaven.
Right, okay.
Is that the point is this is a parable about the kingdom of heaven, what it is like.
Right. This brings me just to referring to Ben Myers' rules for preaching parables, because one of them is that if you haven't mentioned the kingdom, you've done it wrong.
I think we mentioned the kingdom last time. I hope we did. But that is a good point, because most of them are actually about the kingdom. So if you forget that and make it a moral tale, you've missed the big picture point of the parable. Yep.
Yeah. So this one, Robin, the weeds and the wheat, what do you think Jesus is doing here? It seems to me there's a message about the coexistence of evil and good.
In the kingdom. Yes, it's interesting that there's space in this kingdom for both good and bad to grow together.
Or the world as well.
Yeah. Well, see, again,
acknowledging that fact, a bit like the seeds are going everywhere and they'll grow somewhere but not in other places, so similar. Point.
So again, I mean, this is the difficulty with interpreting parables, because we could go to all sorts of allegories. We could see this as a way to talk about the world at large, to talk about the church. I've even heard interpretations of this which make me slightly nervous, because it's playing a bit loose and fast with the original text, but I get it as a spiritual thing, is that we can read this as quite a mystical, personal, or use it to do some personal reflection, which is what is it in each of us that is both, weeds and wheat. That each one of us as individual humans is capable of both good and bad.
That's a bit psychologizing for me.
I know it is. So it does make me nervous. But, I mean, there are multiple levels we could read this. But Jesus is saying this is what the kingdom is like. I think if I had to try and sum it up, I think it's ultimately that, you know, leave it up to the reapists to figure it out. The reapers, the end, as they're called, at harvest time, because the slaves ask, shall we go and gather them? And they're told, no, let them grow together. So there's a sense that judgment will come. This is a judgment parable, eschatological. Judgment will come, but it is God or whoever the owner of this kingdom. Again, not wanting to read God into every parable, but it is – I think I would want to say to contemporary Christians, this is saying to us it's not up to us to judge, because we can't do that discernment.
Yeah, I think Brendan Byrne says something similar about the fact that this is not the judgment that is present in these passages is not about a harshness towards people, but an acknowledgement or a reassurance from Jesus and God that it will be dealt with.
Yes.
Not that I'm out to get you.
No, no.
Not that I'm out to get you, but be reassured, it will be dealt with.
Yeah, which checks us perhaps from being overly judgmental.
Yeah.
Because sometimes we judge things from a limited place of knowledge or a certain...
By definition, most of the time we do, yeah.
Cultural understanding. Mm. We've seen the church do that over centuries, make harsh judgments on people that we would now include and once excluded. But, I mean, it does pose for me a theological question. I don't know, does this bother you, Fran, that there's something about what does it mean that God would allow evil to grow alongside good in the kingdom? I feel like that's challenging.
Well, yes, definitely is. But could we not talk about that also being this is the writers grappling with the reality of life where this is visible and we can see this is what we live in.
Mm.
You know, what do we do about this evil and suffering around us? How does it make sense? And
it makes sense by saying God's decided to let it grow together and sort it out
later.
I'm not saying that's a satisfying
explanation all the time, but that's what's operating here perhaps.
No, and again, this is one story in a myriad of stories. Mm. It is not the final word on what we do with evil in the world or in the church. We should note too that this probably because I say this because we have often talked about the hardness of some of these stories and the call to suffering and persecution at times. But this story, a bit like Romans, where it talked about the glory to come, that, you know, that so much outshines the current suffering. This passage too in verse 43 does talk about the righteous shining like the sun. I mean, there is this image of quite a glorious sort of reward and afterlife once the harvest has happened.
Mm. What do you make of the interpretation?
Well, again, I mean, the interpretation of Jesus, and this is like last week where we've got a parable that's delivered to a wider group, an interpretation that's offered to the disciples, this time in a house, so quite private. I mean, he kind of does this allegorical interpretation, which feels a bit like this means this and this means this. Which
very much.
I just don't love.
No, well, I think, no, I don't either, and it brings me to the first few words at the start of the passage for the Matthew passage for today where he says he put before them another parable. He just keeps putting these things forward because what I'm trying to say is these are pictures into God. These are windows into God. They are we've talked about metaphorical language of the faith. It's the parables are, I mean, they're not utterly unique, but the way Jesus uses them is extremely unusual and the content of them is radically unusual.
Yes.
And so they interpret each other all the time. So I feel like this interpretation that we've got here from verse 36.
Yeah.
Or no.
Yeah.
Yeah, verse 30. Is too tidy and it's like it plays into our simplistic definition of a parable as some sort of representation of a deeper truth.
Mm.
And at the bottom of that, we'll find God somewhere.
So would you say this is the hand of Matthew wanting to tidy it up?
Yes, I would say that.
Yeah.
Yeah. And one of the reasons I would say that too is that Jesus gives two apparently contradictory reasons why he teaches with parables. So in verse 13 of chapter 13, he uses a quote from Isaiah. He told all these things in parables. I will open my mouth to speak in parables. I will proclaim what has been hidden from the foundations of the world. It's from Psalm 78. Basically what he's saying is I use parables in order to conceal and to make ambiguous. And then in verse 34 of that chapter, he says these things in parables. There was nothing he did without a parable.
Mm-hmm.
I'll proclaim what has been hidden from the foundation of the world. That is, I'm using parables to reveal. And it's just that paradox of how God appears to us. And we talked about that way back with the Transfiguration with Dorothy, actually.
Yeah.
And that God appears and then fleeting. It's sort of, I didn't know God was there, but God was there. There's this fleetingness. And I suppose I'm really interested and compelled by the notion that Jesus himself is a parable of God.
Okay.
That it's a window into a, a window, an image of, and that's what that's the teaching form that's going on here.
Yeah.
And that, in fact, in a way, we could be parables, you know, living out the gospel as we're given it by Jesus. So I'm getting very sort of poetical here, but I think there's something a lot more exciting about parables than the sort of little story to give a little truth that we often reduce them to, which interpretations like this here don't help with.
Yeah, and I agree with that, because I think when we read that interpretation, we as preachers are inclined to want to offer a clear one-to-one correlation kind of interpretation.
Oh, well, let's tidy that up then.
Yes, whereas I think part of the way Matthew in this whole chapter is using the Old Testament in quite contradictory ways, as you say, sometimes to conceal, sometimes to reveal, is actually pointing to a deeper tension here between, you know, on the one hand, Jesus is telling them lots of parables about the kingdom. On the other hand, these are mysteries that are hidden from your average person. And so there is a sense that some will get it and some won't. Matthew emphasized, so some of these parables are in other gospels. Matthew's added words around understanding and stuff.
Like,
in terms of what's understood and by whom is quite important to Matthew. But I'd agree with you too with the interpretation has the heavy hand of Matthew as author, because this weeping and gnashing of teeth, the furnace of fire, we're going to get this again in Matthew or several times. We can't in this gospel escape these images of judgment, which for him are kind of warning shots, I think mostly functioning rhetorically.
Yeah.
Again, we're in, you know, when we're in parables, none of this is literal.
No.
It's not a systematic theology of the afterlife or something, but we're using images and stories to kind of paint pictures that invite people to respond and experience God and think about faith.
Well, and particularly to respond to the gift, to the, you know, the objective reality you've actually been given, to respond to that. And there's a costliness to the gift as well, all of those things.
So I think the challenge for preachers when we preach parables might be to not explain but to try and ourselves tell parables or somehow convey something in a sermon that invites imagination.
Playfulness. I mean, it's
all experiences of God.
Yeah, but it's also the fact that all of our language is provisional about God, and that's not to dismiss it. That's to say it's not our task to domesticate and define and entrap and get, much as we love it when there's just a two-line summary of what that means. Whew, great.
Yes, but to resist that temptation.
To resist that temptation. Yeah.
Well, thank you everyone for listening.
Yeah.
You've been listening to By the Well. Until next time.
Oh, that was better than